Okay, and we're back. I just wanted to ask you about a different guest of mine, Francis Boyle, had talked to us about biosafety level 3 and 4 labs, and that's where different types of infectious disease are studied and bred and things like that. Do you come across any of that kind of stuff in your work?
But they aren't wildly infective. That is, it takes really prolonged contact, let's say, with an individual who has the infection to pass it to another individual. So they're not highly infective. They do get infected. They cause a very slow evolving infection. So there's not a rapid infection. So it's not something that you'd see on a TV show where they talk about a wild infection that's killing everybody within minutes type of thing. These can't kill, but they kill indirectly, and they kill in the long run. They kill indirectly by causing a variety of different degenerative diseases in individuals, which then ultimately they would succumb to. So they could cause long-term cardiovascular effects, for example. They could cause long-term neurologic effects, and so on and so forth. So these things aren't immediately fatal, but in the long run they cause a lot of problems.
And when you had mentioned that the Gulf War syndrome, a lot of the vaccines are infected with the mycoplasma or contaminated.
Well, that's what we suspect, because we've never been able to test the vaccine.
I see.
Because they've never made them available. In fact, the only offer that we had to test any of the vaccine was only one lot, and it was from Fort Detrick. Well, they have ways to sanitize the vaccines, of course. It's very easy to do. We were afraid that if we only got one lot and got a negative, and that wouldn't mean anything, because not every lot is probably infected. There are different lots that may have different degrees of contamination. And so just measuring or monitoring one lot would be totally absurd, so we didn't agree to do that.
And what would be the difference between mycoplasma and a different type of infection, like a virus or a bacterial infection?
Well, the mycoplasma is a bacteria, but it's a very primitive bacteria. It's lost a lot of its genome. And because of that, it doesn't live outside of humans, for example, or animals that it infects. It has to get inside the cells within the human or animal for its replication and for its survival. So it is impaired in some ways. So it's not something that would exist out in the wild and proliferate in the wild. Has to be inside the cells inside of us before it can really divide and replicate. So in that regard, it's not nearly as dangerous as a rapidly growing virus or bacteria that really doesn't need to be inside us to proliferate.
And once it exits the body, how does it get from one? How does it survive from one host to another?
Well, these are airborne.
Okay.
But they're also fluid-borne. So sexual intercourse, for example, tears, body fluids can pass the infection.
I see.
Saliva, for example.
For someone who has one of these chronic illnesses, what types of treatments are available for them?
Well, we've found that long-term antibiotic treatment, for example, is eventually effective in suppressing mycoplasma, as long as a number of other things are done to correct some of the other deficiencies that coexist with the mycoplasma. And on our website at the Institute for Molecular Medicine, which is www.immed.org, it's like immediate.org, immed.org, people can find information about how to be tested and how to undergo treatment for these different infections. And so we've had a lot of good experience over the years in helping patients recover from these infections. But it does take a long time, because these are such slow-growing, smoldering intracellular infections, they take a long, treatment takes a long time. It's not like the rapidly growing bacteria or even rapidly growing viruses that can be suppressed more quickly. These infections can't be quickly suppressed, so long-term treatment is required.
Mm-hmm. Besides an antibiotic treatment, what other changes are made with the patient's body? Do you attempt to change their body ecology in some way, or their diet?
We do. We actually do. There are a number of different things that people have to do to improve their immune system, for example, to increase the oxygen levels, for example. These infections are generally suppressed but not killed by high oxygen tension, so there are oxidative therapies, for example, that offer some relief, although they don't kill the organism, they can suppress it. And this is why people, for example, that have these infections, they take long airline flights at high altitude and they immediately, or within a week or two, relapse very heavily from these infections. And so high altitude causes problems. And so there are a number of situations where you can see improvement in the signs and symptoms, but not really get rid of the disease. And so we try and help people build up their immune systems, try and affect their diet, so to decrease their susceptibility to some of the things that go on metabolically with these infections. And there are a number of other things that they have to do as well to help them out. Because these are chronic infections, slow-growing, smoldering infections, it really takes a long-term approach to solve these problems with these infections.
So are different diseases like chronic fatigue, fibromyalgia, Lyme disease, Gulf War syndrome, are these all in the same kind of vein of problems and same vein of treatment?
They are, and they all have overlapping signs and symptoms. And then you have a lot of other diseases like autoimmune diseases, for example, and neurodegenerative diseases that have their own set of signs and symptoms, but they also have some of the common problems that we see in all these different infections. And we've been working on one of the common problems, which is a decrease of mitochondrial function. The mitochondria are the little energy batteries inside your cells that produce the high energy molecules that allow your cells to function and essentially maintain your everyday functions. And particularly when you have to exert physically, for example, you really put the strain on your mitochondria. And if these are damaged, they don't produce enough high energy molecules to help people overcome this, so they feel fatigued, they're not able to do the normal things that they should be doing, so they feel fatigued, they feel tired all the time, and so on. That's, of course, one of the major manifestations of chronic fatigue syndrome, but fatigue is really the most common complaint of all patients with these chronic illnesses, so it's a very common problem. And we found that loss of mitochondrial function occurs across all the chronic diseases, so it's one of the almost universal problems that plague people with chronic illnesses.
Now, I've heard of different substances used as neuroprotectants. Is there anything that's a mitochondrial protectant?
Yes, there is, and we've been working on this for some years, and I've developed a procedure called lipid replacement therapy that replaces the damaged lipids within the mitochondria, and this is important because the little membranes of the mitochondria, particularly the inner membranes of the mitochondria, absolutely have to be pristine in order for mitochondrial function to occur. If they get oxidized or damaged, those lipids allow leakage of ions and so on out of the inner membrane of the mitochondria, and this thwarts the ability of the mitochondria to produce high energy. So it's called oxidative phosphorylation, and it's diminished by about one half or so in chronic illness patients, and also in people who are very old as well. The same thing happens naturally. And we found that the lipids get oxidized and damaged, and we can actually replace these lipids with a food source of lipids. And the differences between the lipids that we use to replace it and the normal things that you might eat, for example, if you ate fish oil or something like that, is that a lot of the lipids that people eat are already oxidized and modified, so that's no good. You can't really replace the oxidized lipids with oxidized lipids from foods. That doesn't help. So we have a way of protecting the lipids so they're not oxidized, and we use specific membrane lipids, and that's kind of unique in this product that we've been working with. And it's taken as a food, and then you slowly replace the damaged lipids in the mitochondria here, recover mitochondrial function. And we've done 6 clinical trials on this already to show that there's not only an increase in mitochondrial function, but it goes along with a decrease in fatigue in patients. We've done one trial on older patients, for example, that are 70 to 95 years old. We've done a trial on chronic fatigue syndrome patients, fibromyalgia syndrome patients. We've done a trial on cancer patients because this occurs during cancer as well. And we've done trials on people with general chronic fatigue that have a number of different chronic illnesses, but they suffer from chronic fatigue. In all those cases, we found a 35 to 45% increase in mitochondrial function and a same type of decrease in fatigue levels in those patients. So it's been very effective, and since it's an all-natural source, it has no toxicity whatsoever. We've never seen any toxicity in any of the clinical trials. And that's to be expected since it's a natural constituent of your mitochondrial inner membrane. So it's a very natural thing. That's why we call it a food, functional food. And so we use this functional food, and it can be put in a number of different products. And actually, tomorrow I have to go down to a company in the San Diego area to discuss putting this as an additive into certain functional foods for people who are chronically ill. So I think it's beginning to show promise in terms of a way to help people. And again, if somebody's chronically ill and wants to find out more about this, they can go on our website at the Institute for Molecular Medicine and find out about how to find out about lipid replacement therapy products that are available.
And so this sounds very good. It's a non-invasive kind of way to start the healing process.
Oh yeah, it's an all-natural functional food approach to repairing your body's damage that occurs in all kinds of chronic illnesses. People with fatigue problems, and of course I mentioned that's the most common complaint of all patients with to go to see a general medical physician. So it's probably useful for most anybody with any illness.
Mm-hmm. Now my guest last week was speaking to us about the endocannabinoid system. Is this something you're familiar with within the body?
Well, we don't really deal too much with that, so I can't really comment.
Okay.
On that. Again, we've dealt primarily in our work with chronic infections and what they do to the body. We've dealt with energy systems in the body, like the mitochondria, which supply the energy for cell function, and what happens, the damage it's caused, and how do we repair that naturally, without the use of drugs. And of course, people that are fatigued and everything, they find out, well, if you go down and buy products or even get prescription products, what are these? They're stimulants, they're drugs, things like caffeine and other stimulants. They don't really help you. They just make you feel like you're less fatigued. What we do is we actually get to the function. Instead of giving somebody a stimulant that hypes them up, we actually repair the mitochondria, which is the basis for their energy in the first place.
That sounds like an appropriate approach.
Well, it certainly is. It's an all-natural, non-toxic approach.
What kind of prevention therapy is there for people who are living in a high Lyme area, or I guess somebody who would be in the military, possibly getting exposed to Gulf War syndrome, or any of these other exposures for these diseases?
Well, there are a number of things that are important. We start with diet, for example. People eat the right kinds of foods, cut out the processed sugar from their diets, for example, and eat all natural foods. Generally, they're going to be healthier, their immune system is going to be healthier, and so on. Then the next thing we do is we work with people's immune systems. There are different ways to amp up or hype up your immune system to deal with some of the chronic infections that are out there and some of the other problems and so on. Then you have to rid people of some of the chemicals and heavy metals that they've been exposed to already. And, most people have a number of these that are on board. There are different ways of doing that, but it's a slow process.
Mm-hmm.
All these natural processes are slow. They're not quick to rid people of contaminants that they've received from the environment. And then if, people's energy systems need to be amped up, hyped up, because they're diminished.
Mm-hmm.
Chronic illness can result in a 35 to 45% decrease in mitochondrial function. And generally that's because the membrane's been damaged in the mitochondria, so we know that lipid replacement therapy will help those people. And so we recommend they go on those lipid replacement products. Then some people are deficient in certain minerals, vitamins, and so on. We make sure that, that's taken care of. And then there are a number of other things that can be done, but those are some of the basic things that we do. If people have infections, that they may need antibiotics or antivirals, but we try and get off of those as soon as we can with most patients, just to try and get them to more natural therapeutic approaches. Once we can build up their immune systems, for example, and get them to the point where they no longer need the antivirals or the antibiotics, their immune systems can take the place of that. But in general, a lot of these things can't be done quickly. They have to be done slowly.
Right.
We're talking about repair and bringing people's natural systems online. And that takes time. It doesn't occur overnight. So there's no magic pill that people can take. There's no magic silver bullet for any of these chronic illnesses.
And the chronic,
it's a slow process.
And the chronic illness, the development of the illness was a slow process.
Yes,
to get
right.
there.
It's a slow process to begin with, and it's a slow process to recover from it.
I see. Are there prescription antivirals?
Yes, there are. I mean, again, depending upon the type of virus that's present and what problem it's causing, there are antivirals. Some of the antivirals have significant side effects, so you have to be very careful with them. And, they can only be used under a physician's care. There's some antibiotics which are, relatively benign compared to most drugs that you might take, and those can be used long term. There are others that have more side effects, and those you have to be very careful of, and they may only be useful short term. So there are a number of different ways in which we can approach these problems, but we take a fairly conservative approach, a fairly benign approach, so that to cause a minimum number of side effects and adverse reactions.
And how do you deal with preserving the beneficial bacteria and viruses within the body?
Well, one thing, your beneficial bacteria, for example, in your gut, there are many more bacteria in your gut than there are cells in your body, and you have to continually replace the friendly bacteria, which are necessary for performance of your gut, all the time. And the substances that are called probiotics do that. They're natural for, capsules or solutions or whatever, a friendly bacteria that you take in every day and helps replenish the friendly bacteria, and that helps outcompete the pathogenic bacteria, the ones that can cause problems. And so that's a necessary part of what we're talking about. The diet is a necessary part of what we're talking about to use diets that are supportive of health rather than diets that are destructive of your health. There are a lot of processed foods, there are a lot of highly oxidized, damaged foods, for example, that are not good for you. And we try and get people off of those, get them on more natural foods, get them off of processed sugar as much as possible, because that causes a number of different problems to your immune system, to your cardiovascular system, and so on and so forth. So there are things that we do to try and suggest people to improve their health.
And would replacing processed sugar with maple syrup, is maple syrup considered not a processed sugar, or would it be processed?
No, all of these things that have sugar or things that can be broken down immediately to sugar products are probably, they're okay in moderate amounts, but of course these days the amount of sugar going into our systems in our current diets are tremendous. I mean, there's such an increase over even 100 years ago. There's just been a dramatic increase in the intake of sugar, the types of things that could be broken down, whether it's high fructose corn syrup or whether it's sugar of various sorts that can be broken down quickly into simple sugars.
Mm-hmm.
We've just been consuming way too much of that. And our bodies are, although they're capable of withstanding that to a certain degree, it does cause its long-term effects. Convinced of this, that a lot of the increase we've seen in diabetes and cardiovascular disease and a number of other things are directly attributable to the increased rates of sugars and different types of fats that we take in. So the types of lipids that I've been talking about in terms of lipid replacement therapy are not the kinds of lipids that get you into trouble. They're actually membrane lipids, which are the good lipids that actually help you. And so these are the functional lipids in your body, not lipids that going to cause you trouble or damage or whatever. So
and that
also
That would be the omega-3s and 6s?
Well, those are, yes, those are considered to be among the good lipids, but that's a general category of lipids. But we're really, of that, we're talking about very specific types of membrane lipids. They're called phosphatidyl lipids. These phosphatidyl lipids, like phosphatidylcholine, phosphatidyl serine, phosphatidyl inositol, for example, these are our membrane phosphoglycolipids, and these are the types of lipids that are used in all our biologic membranes. So we have to continually replace these lipids from natural foods, and what we do is we use functional foods that contain really pure lipid forms of these that are not oxidized, are not damaged, and these can go in and repair the membranes and return them, return the functional aspects of the membranes back to normal.
Okay, well, I'd like to invite the listeners, if you are out there listening, you have any questions for Professor Nicholson, you can give us a call here. The phone number is area code 315-859-4200. That's 315-859-4200. Now, I've heard about the spirochetes involved with Lyme disease are very hard to get rid of because sometimes when you begin to attack them with antibiotics or other medicines that they can insist encapsulate themselves, shrink down into like a ball or a mass. How are they removed from the body being so sneaky?
Well, you know, a lot of the bacteria that we deal with, like chlamydia, mycoplasma, and then the spirochete forms like Borrelia, they do have what we call senescent or quiescent forms, which either they can shrink down to a cyst-like form and just become completely inactive, or they can just simply become metabolically inactive, and then they're not susceptible to the overwhelming antibiotics, the overwhelming types of antibiotics that are used to treat them. Generally, those antibiotics depend upon a metabolically active bacteria to be susceptible to the drug. So they can escape the treatment this way. And it's a natural consequence of the environmental pressure that's put on them to shut down their metabolism. And so they naturally will go into a quiescent form to escape that type of therapy. So this is one of the reasons why long-term therapy is required, because eventually it'll come out of this form,
mm-hmm.
become metabolically active again. And then if they're susceptible, then the treatment could suppress them. But if you just give them short-term therapy, they'll always escape it, because there'll always be some in the population of the bacteria that are quiescent at any one stage, and those will escape that type of therapy because they're not metabolically active. So this is one reason why long-term therapy is required. The other reason is that they're generally slow-growing anyway. So they grow very slowly, and so they stay around for a long time, and so they're not real susceptible to antibiotics in the short term, but in the long term, eventually they are. And unfortunately, my belief is that you never really completely eradicate any of these types of chronic infections. They're always going to be there. But if you build up the immune system and you keep a person metabolically strong, they can keep these in a more quiescent form. So they're essentially inactive and they don't cause a problem. In other words, they're non-symptomatic infections at that point. So we can live with them in our system, even though we probably never get rid of them, as long as we remain healthy. And I think that's the best that can be expected, since you can't totally eradicate these because of their inactive forms.
Mm-hmm. Relating more to Lyme disease, what is done about Herxheimer reactions when you have die-off?
Well, you always have these whenever you start treating any bacterial infection, and the die-off comes because the organism is stressed because of the antibiotic. They're stressed, their metabolism is stressed, and they start to release toxins, and these toxins can cause all kinds of havoc inside our cells, and they also, some of them are killed, and they also release particles which contain their antigens, and that can overstimulate the immune system, and there can be an immune response, since a lot of these are in close proximity to cells. Some of that response can get directed against our normal cells, so it could turn into an autoimmune response. So some people that have autoimmune diseases are actually caused because of these types of infections will stimulate the autoimmunity. And that can continue. If that continues, then it can continue to cause problems long term. So getting rid of the source of infection helps resolve that problem. Although sometimes once it gets started, it's difficult to completely resolve.
Mm-hmm. Any of the treatments you use, are any of them herbal?
Yes, some of the things that we recommend are herbal. Again, we take a multi-pronged approach to this problem by using, traditional Western medicine like antibiotics, antivirals, Eastern medicine with certain herbal approaches, for example, and what I call ultra-modern medicine, which would be ways in which we get at these things through general metabolism, like oxidative therapy and things like this. So, again, it really requires a multi-pronged approach, I think, to totally get free of these diseases.
Uh-huh. And for the, going back to the Gulf War veterans, those people who were exposed in that way, you speculate it was mostly through vaccination. Were there any other exposures for them or that?
Yeah, as I mentioned in my introduction to that, that there were multiple exposures. Certainly for the deployed forces that were in the war zone, they were exposed to a lot of chemicals, for example, and they were also exposed to environmental toxins, even the sand that they were breathing in, the silica can cause problems.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them were exposed to depleted uranium munitions that were used, for example, in the high-velocity artillery shells and tank weapons, tank artillery weapons that use these depleted uranium weapons for armor penetration. These things, after they burn, and that's part of the process of the weapon, when it strikes a target, cause release of uranium oxide. And this is in the environment, and it's like a very, very ultra-fine little particles that wind can blow up into dust, and you can inhale these and get uranium oxide, essentially, into your system. And uranium, of course, even depleted uranium, still has considerable radioactivity in it. Eventually, this can cause problems. We don't know how many of the forces were exposed to DU and whether how many of them actually have health consequences because of that. They're generally long-term because it eventually migrates into the bone where it could cause long-term low-level radiation. So eventually, these problems will come out in some patients. But there were a lot of people that came down with Gulf War syndrome, Gulf War illness, that were nowhere near depleted uranium munitions. They were, on ships and aircraft carriers and so on in the Gulf, and they were back in Saudi Arabia or Kuwait, nowhere near the danger zones for that. Some of these people may have been exposed to chemical weapons, of which there were some that were used during the Gulf War. Again, we don't know the number that were exposed to that, but it's probably not large. But we know that very large numbers were exposed to contaminants in the vaccines. So there were, hundreds of thousands of veterans that were vaccinated, probably over 500,000 were vaccinated, and received these multiple military vaccines. And some of them may have had contaminants in the vaccine, like the mycoplasma. So they may have gotten it from the vaccine. So that's why we found that some people who were never deployed but received the military vaccines because the war ended so soon came down with essentially Gulf War illness, but they were never deployed to the Gulf.
Mm-hmm.
And it came down because they had the mycoplasma from the vaccine. So family members of Gulf War veterans that came down ill after the veterans returned to the home, normally the illnesses were slowly evolving, but in the family members they were also slowly evolving. And 6 months to a year after the veterans came home, their family members started to get sick, their children started to become autistic, the wives and spouses started to come down with chronic fatigue syndrome and fibromyalgia syndrome, and that was probably directly due to the mycoplasma being slowly passed as an airborne infection within the immediate families. So we had that to contend with. So we actually have a publication on that on our website on the family member study, showing that autistic children and adults that came down with chronic fatigue syndrome-like illnesses had this infection, this mycoplasma fermentans infection, and they undoubtedly got it from their exposed spouse that was a veteran.
Mm-hmm.
So we can explain the illnesses in the families this way.
And is there anything for family members to do to protect themselves who haven't been exposed to it yet, but may be exposed to it from a spouse returning in the future?
Sure. As we've been discussing before, your general health is very important. So if you're very healthy, if you're on the right diet, if you're taking the right things, maintaining your health, you'll be pretty resistant to most any type of infection.
Mm-hmm.
If on the other hand you get run down and you don't have a proper diet and you don't take care of yourself, you just make yourself much more susceptible. So even within families, for example, these Gulf War families, we found that some individuals in the families are perfectly healthy. Others came down with chronic illnesses, and we found that the ones that came down with chronic illness were the ones that were infected. But we also found that there was a fairly reasonably high incidence of infection in the healthy members, that they just never showed the symptoms because they were able to fight it off, even though they were exposed. So most people are exposed to these and other infections during their lifetime, and they withstand them if they're healthy.
Mm-hmm.
If they're not healthy, and if they have some problems, then they're much more susceptible to getting sick because of the infections.
I see. So when we think back to the past of grandmothers telling their children to take cod liver oil for health, that may be a form of mitochondrial support?
It could be if they had very good cod liver oil. Most cod liver oil, unfortunately, is pretty rancid. That is, it's pretty oxidized to begin with. In fact, most sources of lipids, even the ones that you see commercially that are advertised as health products, won't do you any good because they're partially oxidized. So it really is dependent upon the quality of the product.
And if you're familiar with the taste of non-rancid products, you could tell the difference in quality just by the taste of the product?
Well, a non-rancid product shouldn't have any taste at all, essentially. Rancid product, this is kind of a gross oversimplification, will tend to have some taste to it, some smell to it. So if it has some smell, some taste, it's probably partially rancid to begin with.
Well, that's...
It's just like a fish. If you take a fresh fish out, right out of the water, it's just pristine, and rip it open and open the flesh and smell barely anything to smell. You leave that sitting out for an hour or two, and all of a sudden it starts to have a smell. You leave it out for a day, and it stinks like hell.
Uh-huh.
Well, that's the oxidation process, the natural oxidative process that creates rancid lipids, and they tend to smell. They tend to stink.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting because I wasn't familiar with rancidity and years ago, and now I'm realize that a lot of the nuts that I buy at the store are rancid, I can recognize the flavor of a rancid product.
Well, good for you. I mean, most people don't have this acuity. They don't have this sense of what's good for them and what isn't. And they think it's good for them if the label says it's good for them. And, you know, a lot of products that the label says it's good for you, you know, they're junk. And you just have to know the difference. And I think we need to inform consumers that they just need to pay more attention to the food that they're eating. It really makes a big difference.
Is there anything that I haven't asked you about that you'd like to speak about?
Well, I think we've actually covered a lot of different territory, and
mm-hmm.
if you don't have any specific questions, I'd just like to mention our website again because people can find out a lot more about what we've been discussing.
Please do.
The Institute for Molecular Medicine is a nonprofit research organization which does work on chronic illnesses. Their discovery, testing, and treatment. And the website is www.immed.org. You can remember it by immediate.org. And as a nonprofit, of course, we're always struggling to get funds. Every nonprofit is these days. So if
mm-hmm.
people are interested in helping our causes, they can certainly make a tax-deductible donation. We appreciate it very much.
Well, I'm sure all the people that you're helping appreciate your services very much.
Well, they do, and of course, since there's no fee for any of the things that we do to help people, a lot of people are generous and they make a donation, so that helps us. But not everybody can do that, and we're willing to help them in any case.
Well, I didn't realize that was part of your services.
Well, I get a lot of people that contact us because they have unusual illnesses or diseases, and they can't get any help from physicians, because they don't fall in a simple category of illness, a simple diagnostic category. And that's a real problem, because if you don't fit into one of these diagnostic categories, generally you can't get much help. And so people with unusual problems often you know, ask us for help. We can sometimes point them in certain directions. Other times we can give them some advice and so on. So, again, we're a nonprofit, so we don't turn people away that want help, but we can't physically bring people into our laboratories. We don't really have a clinic. We have mostly laboratories. We have a lot of physicians that we collaborate with, but we're not allowed to take people directly and treat them. But what we do is give them information to take to their physician and so on. Only if they're within a clinical trial. We're actually running a clinical trial right now in chronic fatigue syndrome and Lyme disease. It's people can go to our website and find out more about that and see if they might qualify. But within those trials, of course, we do offer treatment for people. But that's the only thing we can do.
Well, thank you so much for speaking with us today and taking the time to do so.
Well, I appreciate having me on to broaden the discussion in this area. It's an important area.
Take care.
Bye.
We just heard from Professor Garth Nicholson, and once I post this recording onto Radio for All, I will also post a link to his website. Next, we're going to hear Bucky Bacaw's Backyard Chicken broadcast on the meaning of May Jubilees.
An opportunity to tie an